Yes, ma'am. It's just you. I'm looking at trying to see who all was in the call. So it's just the two of you in the call right now.
Okay, great.
The other person?
This is Julia, Cheryl.
Oh, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine.
Good.
Donna Baird.
Hi, Donna. This is Julia, and we also have Dr. Cheryl Walker on the line.
Hello.
Hi, Donna.
Are both of you on the East Coast?
You're in Texas.
The third coast.
Oh, you're in Texas, Cheryl, right?
Yep, I'm the third coast.
I'm in North Carolina.
Wow. Got different time zones. I don't know if you two had a chance to take a look at the webpage.
Hi, it's Michael.
For this call. Hi, Michael. It's Dr. Cheryl Walker and Dr. Donna Baird on the line with
you. Oh, we're delighted to have you both on.
Hello.
How are you? I'm Michael Lerner. I'll be facilitating the call.
Hi, Michael. I'm on. It's Eleni.
Hi, Eleni.
Michael, I trust that you received the short titles of the presenters.
I do.
Right.
I have it all here. So, Eleni, is Allie or Mary going to go first?
Eleni?
I think we lost the line. Eleni, are you on?
You might actually be talking to the operator about some of the logistics of the call.
Is that Julia?
Yeah.
Eleni Sotos. I'm trying to find out if Dr. Pete Myers is on the line.
Eleni, you're talking to all of us, right?
Yeah, well, I believe so.
Yeah.
Have folks been joining in?
I haven't heard anybody.
Yeah, we haven't heard anything.
Yeah.
Okay, the operator said that everyone...
Pete, did you just join?
Susan's on.
Jeff Anderson here.
Okay, great.
Okay.
Could others announce themselves if you've joined, just so we know who's on?
Donna.
Great.
Jeannie Rizzo, good morning.
Hey, Jean.
Hi, Jeannie.
Ms. Otis, I'm not showing Mr. Myers on the line yet.
Okay, yeah, I'm going to be doing a little bit of a roll call to see if all the speakers are on. So. So do you have, can I do this with you, or I can actually do it live as well?
Sure. Well, however you want to do it.
Let's okay. Well, if you can tell me it right off the bat, if you know if our speakers are on. I know Dr. Myers, you said, is not on.
Lenny,
I know
Cheryl Walker's on, and Donna Barrett is on.
Oh, great. Thank you.
So, Marcia, Mark.
Welcome, Marcia. Good morning.
Good morning. I mean, good afternoon. I don't know which it is.
Good morning for us, Kitty.
Nope, friends on yet.
Is who on? Hi, this is Mary. Mary Tyler Johnson.
Good morning, Mary.
Hi.
And Mary Wade's also on.
Morning, Mary.
Hello.
We are looking for Dr. Prinz, Dr. Gail Prinz, and Dr. Anna Soto, and Dr. Myers. We will wait a moment. We are at the top of the hour. We're going to wait a couple of moments until we get critical mass. And while we're doing that, everyone, this is Eleni Sotos. I'm the national coordinator of CHE. Just a couple of announcements. We have a call, our national partnership call, scheduled for this month on December 12th at 9 a.m. Pacific, noon Eastern. The title of the call is Rethinking Autism Towards a Whole Body Paradigm. And if you're interested in participating in that call, feel free to email Julia Varshavsky, and her email address is julia@healthandenvironment.org. And also to mention to folks, if you go to our website in the What's New box, our website is www.healthandenvironment.org. In the What's New box on our homepage, we have a couple of links you might be interested in. One is to our live blog, which I'll mention in my introduction, where you can post comments and questions. And also there is a link to today's call that will lead you to some of our resources and links for that are relevant to today's topic. Do we have Dr. Anna Soto or Dr. Gail Prinz?
I'm still not showing either one of them on the line.
Okay.
Mr. Myers has joined in.
Okay, welcome, Dr. Myers.
Nancy Alderman, Environment and Human Health.
Morning and welcome.
Thank you.
Nancy Alderman, Environment and Human Health.
Oh. Welcome, Nancy. Good morning.
Good morning.
Nancy Alderman, Environment and Human Health.
Oh, I think that maybe somebody has their audio stream on and playing
it. Oh, me. Must be Nancy Alderman. I'll have to get off and fix it.
Okay, thank you.
This is Elise Miller.
Good morning, Elise.
Good morning.
And yes, to let everyone know, we do have a live streaming audio set up for this call, and again, you can access that by going to our homepage at www.healthandenvironment.org and clicking in the What's New box the link for today's call, and it will take you to the live audio stream for those of you who may be interested in that. And we will be archiving the call as well.
Eleni, would you mention the blog also?
Yes, I will mention that again. If you also go to our homepage on the What's New box on the left side, we have a live blog that we have set up, and you can post comments and questions, and we will be monitoring the blog and selecting questions for the presenters once those finish.
What's the first one? I'm now on to the second. Could you give me that web page again?
Sure. It's www.healthandenvironment.org.
Oh, yeah. I'm just using my cell
phone. And, Julia, I'd like you to ask you to reach Dr. Soto and Dr. Prinz if they have not joined.
Oh, this is Dr. Prinz.
Oh, wonderful.
Hi,
and Dr. Soto has also joined.
Oh, perfect. All righty. Well, then we can actually begin. So, operator, if Kelly, if I might ask you to please place everyone except for the speakers in listen-only mode and let me know when that is busy.
Okay, just one moment. Okay, Ms. Otis, everyone's line is in monitor.
Okay, and can folks hear me?
Yes.
Okay, perfect. Yes. And we'll begin. I'd like to welcome everyone. My name is Eleni Sotos. Today's teleconference is focusing on endocrine disruption in cancer. The moderator for this call will be Michael Lerner, who is the president of Commonweal and co-founder of the Collaborative on Health and the Environment. We are delighted to announce that this call is the result of joint collaboration between the CHAE Fertility and Early Pregnancy Compromise Working Group, the Cancer Working Group, and the new Women's Health and the Environment Working Group. Please note that we are offering the opportunity for call participants to post questions and comments on a live blog during today's call. No special software other than a connection to the Internet is needed. CHAE staff are monitoring the blog during the call. If you'd like to access it, visit our homepage at www.healthandenvironment.org. If you go to the What's New box and click on the blog, it will take you to the blog page. We also have links relevant to today's call, resources and links, and you can access those by clicking also in the What's New box on the link to today's call on the homepage. Please note that everyone on the call, with the exception of our guest speakers, has been placed in listen-only mode. At the conclusion of the presentations, the operator will unmute all of the lines so that you may participate in the Q&A period if you choose. To be mindful of the process during the Q&A period, please identify yourself before you speak and please keep your comment or question brief. The call will last 1 hour. It is being recorded, and an audio MP3 file will be available on the CHAE website for downloading within the next week or so. Please note that the December National Partnership Call titled Rethinking Autism Towards a Whole Body Paradigm is scheduled for December 12th at 9 a.m. Pacific, noon Eastern. To RSVP for this call, please contact Julia Varshavsky at juliaandhealthandenvironment.org. I'd now like to ask Allison Carlson, facilitator of the Fertility and Early Pregnancy Compromise Working Group, and Mary Tyler Johnson, coordinator of the Women's Health and the Environment Working Group, to say a few words. Let's start with Allison and then Mary. Allison, are you on the line? Okay, operator, if you can unmute Allison Carlson, why don't we start with Mary Tyler Johnson, assuming that she is also unmuted.
Okay. Eleni, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you, Mary. Go ahead.
Wonderful. Welcome to everyone. And I'm just going to provide some quick background on the new CHAE National Working Group on Women's Health and the Environment, which has been formed to address the growing body of scientific evidence linking various women's health concerns with environmental contaminants. And the working group evolved out of a CHAE New York meeting held this past June, where over 70 environmental and public health advocates from the tri-state area came together to discuss some of the latest science related to women's environmental health. And the working group is now part of a new National Women's Health and Environment Initiative, which is led by a group of organizations working at the nexus of women's health and the environment. And the CHAE Women's Health and Environment Working Group hopes to work in collaboration with this larger initiative, as well as with the CHAE Cancer and CHAE Fertility and Early Pregnancy Compromise Working Groups, to better understand and translate the science behind this range of environmental health outcomes that we're seeing among women and girls. And similar to other CHAE working groups, the Women's Health and Environment Working Group will operate through quarterly discussion calls and a listserv to discuss cutting-edge science, education, and policy issues. And we welcome you to join us in these discussions. If you're interested in joining the working group, I'd ask you to please send an email to Julia Varshavsky. And again, her email is julia@healthandenvironment.org. And that's all. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Mary. And do we have Allison Carlson on the line?
I'm on. Can you hear me now?
Yes, well, you're perfect, Allison. Go ahead.
Great. Thanks. Well, the news from CHAE Fertility is pretty much all about the National Summit on Environmental Challenges to Reproductive Health and Fertility that we're co-organizing with the chair of obstetrics and gynecology at UCSF, Linda Judice. CHAE's founding chairman, Phil Lee, is co-chairing. And it's January 28th through 30th in San Francisco. There's a link from CHAE's homepage to the summit for complete information and registration. We have a dynamite preeminent faculty who will provide overviews of the science linking contaminants with male and female reproductive health and infertility, organized around the reproductive lifespan. In fact, several speakers on today's call are part of that faculty. Town hall discussions and breakout groups will focus on translation of the research to the clinic, policy, health, professional education, critical research directions and cross-discipline collaboration, and the nexus between reproductive health advocacy and justice and environmental and worker health and justice. And we'll define next steps for a variety of stakeholders at the meeting. So this expands on the Vallombrosa workshop we hosted in 2005. It was a thrilling experience, so we hope that CHAID partners will check out the summit program, share it with their networks, and register to attend.
Great. Thank you very much, Allison. Okay, and now I would like to turn the call over to Michael Lerner. Michael?
Thank you, Elaine. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Great. Well, welcome all. This is a very important joint call of CHAID Cancer, CHAID Fertility, and the CHAID Women's Environmental Health Working Groups, as you've heard. And we're starting with a science update from Pete Myers. Pete?
Great. Thank you very much. Can you hear me, first of all?
Yes.
Given the numbers of speakers, I thought I'd be very brief today and then simply point people toward a very important paper that Leonard Hardell and his colleagues recently published in the American Journal of Industrial Medicine. This is important because it pertains to scientists who don't disclose their links to industry. And in particular, what it reveals is that one of the authors of one of the most influential papers ever written in cancer epidemiology, Sir Richard Dahl, had a long-standing financial relationship with Monsanto between 1970 and 1990. Sir Dahl deposited his private papers with a repository when he retired, and Hardell and his colleagues discovered voluminous documentation about this relationship, and that's what their article summarizes. The other thing I would point you toward is an article in a publication called Inside Higher Ed, which was just published today. It discusses the challenge that journals face as they struggle to deal with disclosure issues, given the wide range of scientists who actually do have varying degrees of association with industry. Both of the links, there are links to both of these publications on the blog right now if you're interested in pursuing them. So I'll stop there.
Pete, thank you very much. And just to add to Pete's comment about the Hardell article, the really key point for many of us, among others, is that Sir Dahl is the person who created the theory that no more than 5% of all cancers are related to environmental contaminants, which is still cited by the American Cancer Society and the National Cancer Institute as a definitive estimate. So these conflicts of interest have had a long and powerful impact in the field, and I'm grateful to Pete for bringing this study to our attention. We have a very full call today. Our first speaker, Dr. Anna Soto, Professor of Anatomy and Cellular Biology at Tufts University, will be speaking about her work on breast cancer and bisphenol A, among other things. She's a distinguished CHAID colleague. And Dr. Soto, you have 5 minutes. Please tell us what you're working on.
Thank you very much, Michael. I would like to comment on 2 points that are relevant to the issue today. The first is the prevalent view that cancer is a cell-based phenomenon due to DNA mutations. And this concept is being challenged due to several reasons. One is the lack of progress in treatment of solid tumors. Another is that cancer cells, when injected into normal tissues, they are normalized. And another is that many substances that do not cause mutations, cause cancer anyway. This and many other additional experimental findings suggest that cancer may arise from epigenetic phenomena rather than from mutations. Epigenesis, in its broader meaning, means a process that changes the physical appearance without changing the DNA sequence. For example, all the cells of the organism contain the same DNA sequence, but look different and perform different functions. Fetal development is the prime example of epigenesis. Epigenetic changes occur through different pathways. Dr. Prince today is going to talk about epigenesis due to changes in the structure of DNA without changing its sequence, that is, without mutations. Dr. Walker is going to allude to a type of process, epigenetic process, that affects the way in which DNA is packed by affecting proteins present in chromatin. There are additional epigenetic processes, such as those mediating communication among cells, and those are the ones that interest me particularly. In our book, The Society of Cells, we conceptualize carcinogenesis as development going wrong. In this view, a chemical need not be a mutagen to cause cancer, but it will act by altering the reciprocal interactions between tissues, tissue components like cells and extracellular matrix. These interactions are those that form normal tissues during development and repair tissues during adult life. So, guided by these theories, I would like to address the second point, that is that we run experiments to assess whether bisphenol A would increase the propensity to breast cancer if it is animals are exposed in utero. And indeed it did. Fetal exposure to BPA at all the doses tested, including those that are current exposure doses for humans in this country, significantly increased the number of preneoplastic lesions in the mammary gland of the exposed animals. And this effect was observed at puberty and it maintained later in life. The type of lesions that we observe are called intraductal hyperplasias and are considered the precursors of carcinomas both in rodents and in humans. They have been shown to develop palpable tumors when they are transplanted into appropriate hosts with intact ovaries. We also found that the treatment of these animals with a single dose of carcinogen when they reached puberty resulted in the development of tumors only in the animals that were exposed in utero to BPA. And those tumors were palpable and large. So this data indicates that exposure to BPA in utero increases the propensity to develop mammary cancer after a second insult. But we also observed that fetal exposure to BPA per se resulted in development of carcinomas in situ in the mammary gland of approximately one-third of the animals that were exposed to a dose of 250 micrograms per kilo per day, a dose that is about five times above the EPA safe dose. And these cancers were observed only in the animals exposed to BPA and only when they arrived at they became adults. So I should say that carcinomas in situ, when they are found in the breast of a woman, she will be recommended by her physician to undergo either lumpectomy and radiation or a simple mastectomy. So those are cancers. What is the relevance of all these experiments in rats to cancer in women? Well, I think that we asked the same question about 20 years ago regarding the DS syndrome, and colleagues ran the appropriate experiment that was to expose rats to DS and see whether or not they would develop breast cancer. They found an increased propensity to breast cancer. And the comment by everyone was, oh, those are just rats. But 2 decades later, that is now, when these women are reaching the age at which breast cancer becomes prevalent, these DS daughters are showing an increased incidence of breast cancer. So in that case, what happened in the rat later on happened in the humans. Moreover, epidemiological studies comparing dizygotic twins with single births also reveal that there is more propensity to breast cancer in the dizygotic twins, and that was attributed to the presence of two placentas and therefore to more estrogens in the dizygotic twins. So our results not only support the notion that prenatal exposure to BPA would increase the propensity to breast cancer, but also that estrogens in general may increase the risk. So most of the effects I described, again, were observed at environmentally relevant doses. So this is very worrisome to me because the incidence of breast cancer has increased by threefold in the last 50 years since introduction of endocrine disruptors such as BPA into the environment. There is a lot more to add to it, but I think I should stop here.
Thank you so much, Dr. Soto, for that very important presentation. Our next presentation is by Dr. Gail Prince, Professor of Physiology, University of Illinois at Chicago, in the Department of Urology. Dr. Prince, you have 5 minutes.
Thank you very much. My work has focused on looking at the prostate gland and the incidences of prostate cancer. Now, everyone is familiar with the DES exposures that Anna just talked about to women with their daughters having increased rates of carcinomas and other reproductive abnormalities. And the question has long been asked whether the sons of the women who took DES during their pregnancy also might be susceptible to prostate cancer abnormalities because the prostate is a hormone-regulated gland. And so in rodent models that we've looked at this to assess this, the epidemiology studies in human are very, very limited, but in rodent models it's been able to show that high-dose exposure to estradiol or DEF can in fact cause prostate neoplasias in the adult animals, suggesting that there may be increased risk for prostate cancer in the sons of DES-exposed women. What we did recently is we moved into the study field of xenoestrogens, and particularly with regards to bisphenol A. There have been many studies done with bisphenol A in the prostate gland using that as the endpoint, and at low environmentally relevant doses, while the prostate in some studies has been somewhat bigger, it has not shown any pathology. What we did in our recent study, myself and my colleague Shuk Mei Ho at the University of Cincinnati, is we exposed our male rats to a low dose of bisphenol A during the period of prostate development immediately after birth and allowed these animals to grow to adulthood, and the prostates did not look abnormal. We then asked a question similar to what Anna Soto was doing. Well, what if we give to bisphenol A in during development and then expose the animals to elevated estradiol when they're older? Elevated estradiol normally takes place in the aging male, so we try to recapitulate this. And what we found out in our model was that bisphenol A exposed animals had a significantly higher susceptibility to prostate carcinogenesis as induced by elevated estrogens in adulthood. Normally, the elevated estrogens induced an incidence of 40% prostate neoplastic lesions, whereas if they saw bisphenol A neonatally, 100% of the animals showed prostatic lesions. We then went to ask the question, how might this take place? How could this early exposure affect the prostate gland months later? And one area we investigated was epigenetics that Anna just mentioned. And we looked at the methyl groups that are attached to DNA. This is called DNA methylation. And we looked at the methylation status of all the genes in a global screen. And we were able to identify over 50 candidate genes that had different types of methylation patterns based on whether they were exposed to bisphenol A or low doses of estradiol as compared to the control animals. And so this suggests to us that bisphenol A can affect what we call the epigenome of the prostate, the DNA methylation status. We looked at one gene in particular, phosphodiesterase 4, which breaks down cyclic AMP in the cells. And we find that in the normal prostate gland, this gene becomes methylated as the animal ages, and it shuts down the expression of this gene. However, if the animals were exposed to a low dose of bisphenol A neonatally, not only did it not shut down, did it not methylate this gene, it actually removed all previous methyl groups on this gene. And this resulted in a continued high expression of this enzyme all the way through adulthood. And so now we have evidence that there's a direct link between early exposures of BPA and molecular changes that are happening in the tissue that then allow that tissue to be more susceptible to prostate cancer in the aging animal. And one of the exciting things we were able to determine is that these altered patterns of DNA methylation could be observed way before any histology changes in the gland. They could, in fact, be observed before we even gave them adult estradiol. And so we think that we have an animal model that suggests that bisphenol A can be added to the list of xenoestrogens that can affect prostate carcinogenesis risk in the aging animal. We speculate that a similar mechanism may be happening in human, but this will await future studies. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Prince, for another elegant and very important summary of work. Grateful to you for that. Our third speaker is Dr. Cheryl Walker, Professor, University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center in the Department of Carcinogenesis. Dr. Walker, you have 5 minutes.
Thank you, Michael. So we've heard now this morning about the two most important components of any type of cancer, which is the genetic component and the epigenetic, or in this particular case, a hormonal component. And for female cancers in particular, such as breast and uterine cancer, these two components are really, really critical. So for instance, if you inherit a genetic defect in a gene such as BRCA, this mutation can increase your lifetime risk of developing breast or ovarian cancer by 60 to 80%. But just as importantly are the female hormones, particularly estrogen, which is also required and likely drives the process of tumor development. And in fact, in the absence of these hormones, these tumors are rarely, if ever, seen. So recently we've been asking questions about this hormonic component of cancer, and especially how chemicals in our environment, those that can mimic hormones, might be co-opting this process to promote tumor development. So to address this issue, we focused on tumors of the uterus, and you're going to hear a little more from Donna Barrett about these really, really important tumors of women. They're called uterine leiomyomas, sometimes termed fibroids, but they're the most common tumor of women. And we chose an animal model for this disease where the genetic part of the equation was already in place. So the animals we use for our studies have a mutation in a gene that will predispose to the development of these tumors. So this really allowed us to focus in on the hormonal part of the equation. So in our study, we exposed female animals to different types of xenoestrogens for a very brief period of time, for 3 days, when their uterus was developing. And in the rat, this period of development is the first 2 weeks after birth. Now, initially we used diethyl sildesterol, DES, for these experiments, and we've actually published those results. But we've also reproduced these studies now for both bisphenol A and for genistein. So after we exposed these female rats to the chemicals for 3 days, we then followed the animals until they were 16 months old, which would be equivalent to a woman approaching menopause. And we asked the question, well, what effect did that hormone exposure months before that occurred shortly after birth, what effect did that have on the risk of developing these uterine tumors in the adult females? Well, remarkably, what we found was that the females that were exposed to xenoestrogen shortly after birth had a huge increase in the risk of developing the tumors. In the control group of animals, for example, the genetic that had the genetic defect but were not exposed to xenoestrogen, about half of the females developed uterine leiomyoma. Now, in contrast, the animals that saw DES briefly after birth, 100% of those female rats developed the tumors. The tumors were much larger, averaged 5 times larger than in the unexposed animals, and they were more numerous. So this demonstrated that we had increased the risk of developing these tumors by this brief, inappropriate exposure to the xenoestrogen. So the question then became, what was the mechanism that was responsible for this dramatic change in risk? So normally, during development, the uterus is protected from hormones by proteins in the blood that can bind maternal estrogen and any hormones that are being made by the developing female. This keeps the developing uterus in an estrogen-naive state until much later in life, when these binding proteins are then cleared by the liver, the animal reaches puberty and starts making her own hormones. However, xenoestrogens such as DES are able to escape this protective mechanism. They're able to reach the uterus, and they can actually act like estrogen, turning on estrogen-responsive genes. Well, we found that this inappropriate interaction between the xenoestrogens and the developing uterus led to the turning on of many estrogen-responsive genes at a time when they are normally protected from estrogen and silent. So as a result of this early inappropriate hormone exposure during this key time of development and differentiation, these genes became turned on too early, were reprogrammed, and then in the adult, these genes were now hypersensitive to the normal hormone estrogen. So due to this acquired hypersensitivity, these genes were much more sensitive to estrogen and were turned on even in the presence of very, very low levels of hormone that would not normally have turned these genes on. And it was this constant expression of these estrogen-responsive genes that were now driving tumor development. So this study demonstrated that developmental programming following exposure of the uterus to xenoestrogen can permanently reprogram a normal physiologic response, in this case, the response to estrogen, and can result in an increased responsiveness to hormone that can promote tumor development in the adult. Now, interestingly, our new data suggests that this reprogramming is happening by modifying proteins that associate with DNA to form chromatin, and that these modifications are being triggered by estrogens through what is termed non-genomic signaling pathways. So as Anna was talking about earlier, much like direct modifications to the DNA itself, these protein modifications can also regulate gene expression, and most importantly, these modifications are heritable. So we believe that the ability of xenoestrogens to trigger through this non-genomic signaling, leading to modification of chromatin-associated proteins such as histones, is reprogramming the way the genes are expressed in the adult, making them hypersensitive to estrogen and promoting tumor development. So the take-home message from our studies is that early in life, the genome of a susceptible individual can be reprogrammed following an environmental exposure in a way that will increase the probability of developing cancer later in life. So when we think about gene-environment interactions, the timing of the environmental exposure may be critical. And in genetically susceptible individuals, exposures that occur early in life may have as great or greater impact on tumor outcome as those that occur during their adult life. Thank you.
Dr. Walker, thank you again for a third brilliant and important presentation, deeply relevant to our collective.
Did I lose the group?
No, we're here, and I just want to thank you again for that important presentation. Our final presentation is by Dr. Donna Bayard, who is a reproductive epidemiologist with the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences. Dr. Bayard, you have 5 minutes.
Thank you, Michael. Following up the comments that Anna made regarding the relationship between the animal models of DES and the human data, we had the opportunity to test data on leiomyomas, uterine fibroids, in women. They had been found to be elevated in the exposed animal models, and this was a chance to test that hypothesis in women. We've been studying uterine fibroids in our epidemiology program here at the Institute, and I'm going to share two findings with you today regarding that. The biggest challenge for studying fibroids in women is that a large number of fibroids go untreated and even undiagnosed. And whether or not the fibroids get diagnosed and treated depends on a lot of factors that aren't just related to the characteristics of the fibroids. Studying pathology diagnosed cases, for example, may be misleading. The fibroids are a leading cause of hysterectomy in the United States, but only an estimated 10% of women with fibroids actually have surgery. And the choice of whether to have surgery, especially a hysterectomy, depends on a lot of factors, including the desire to have more children. So if a study finds differences between women with and without fibroids that has been based on hysterectomy or surgery cases, those differences may not be true risk factors for fibroids, but rather it may be factors related to choosing to have surgery. So to overcome this problem, we based our epidemiologic study on ultrasound evidence of fibroids. We randomly selected women aged 35 to 49 from a large urban health plan. We asked them to undergo a study ultrasound examination where they would be screened for fibroids. We sought medical records for the women who had already had hysterectomy. We enrolled 500 white women, 800 black women, and were able to determine fibroid status for about 90% of them. A surprisingly high proportion of women had fibroids. 35% of those who we screened had been diagnosed with fibroids before screening, and in nearly all those cases, the screening confirmed the prior diagnosis. Of those with no prior diagnosis, half had at least one fibroid at screening. We collected blood and conducted an extensive telephone interview with the participants to collect information on potential risk factors. We were interested in finding out whether DES was a risk factor for fibroids, so during the interview, we asked about prenatal DES exposure. Only 5 black women reported DES exposure, so we limited our analysis to white women, but anecdotally, all 5 of those women had fibroids. 19 white women reported DES exposure, and even with these limited numbers, there was a statistically significant increase in fibroids among the exposed. The age-adjusted relative odds for fibroids was 2.4, confidence interval 1.1 to 5.4, and the association tended to be stronger for large fibroids, odds ratio 3.1. 71 women were unsure of their DES exposure status, and they also had an elevated risk of fibroids of 1.4, though it was not statistically significant. These results were essentially unchanged when we controlled for potential confounders and when we conducted several sensitivity analyses. Thus, our data support the laboratory data that show increased risk of fibroids after prenatal exposure to DES. There's one other study that has examined the association between DES and fibroids in women. Lauren Weiss at Harvard and her colleagues examined rates of surgery for uterine fibroids for exposed and unexposed women in 2 DES cohorts. And this study found no association between DES exposure and fibroids. This study had the advantage of documented exposure data, whereas ours was self-report, but it has the disadvantage of being limited to surgery cases. Because DES-exposed women have more fertility problems, it's likely that they're less willing to have a hysterectomy for fibroids. If this is the case, studying surgical cases will underrepresent the true number of exposed women with fibroids. However, this is just really speculation at this point. What we really need is ultrasound screening of a sample of women in these cohorts with well-documented exposure. Then the second point I wanted to mention is another finding in our study that seems particularly relevant to the possible role of epigenetic changes in tumor development. Our study shows that pregnancy appears to be protective for fibroids, and this is consistently found in other studies as well. We hypothesized that these findings might be explained by loss of early fibroid lesions during the uterine remodeling process following a pregnancy. After delivery, the uterus doesn't just shrink back to size. There's extensive cell death. There's also extensive cell proliferation. Essentially, the organ is rebuilt, and small fibroids might be cleared from the uterus at this time. I think it's particularly relevant to today's discussion because the postpartum period may be another one of those windows when the uterus may be especially vulnerable to environmental exposures. Just as there appear to be that window of susceptibility to environmental estrogens during prenatal development, there well may be another window of susceptibility during postpartum uterine remodeling. We're focusing on that in a current epidemiologic study, and I'd love to see that tested in animal models. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Baird. And I just want to say these 4 presentations have been just stunningly good and cogent and really a model of some of the best calls we've had in the collaborative. So to all 4 of you and to Pete Myers, our collective gratitude. It's quite awesome to have all of this presented together and give us an opportunity to reflect on it together. So So I open the floor to comments. Please keep your comments brief. State your name and affiliation before you comment. And please consider using the blog. It's very easy, and a number of people may want to comment, so the blog will help us, and I may pick some of those out to add to the conversation. So the floor is open.
Mike, we need to ask the operator to please put everyone in talk listen mode.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. So, operator, if you could please do that and let us know when that's done, I'd appreciate it.
Yes, ma'am. Everyone is in monitor. I mean, everyone's in talk.
Eleni, do you want to ask people to put themselves on?
No, I don't think we need to do that. I think we've been doing well without that.
All right, thanks.
Thank you.
So, comments, please.
Well, I guess I'd like to make a comment, if I could, or a question.
Who is this, please?
Hmm?
Who is this?
Oh, it's Nancy Alderman, Environment and Human Health.
Yeah.
My question is, because most of the baby bottles today are made out of plastic, and most of them have BPA, bisphenol A, and from what everybody is saying, these very early exposures are so serious. How do we get this fixed, seeing most of our infants today, if they're not breastfed, they're being raised on plastic baby bottles with bisphenol A?
I'd like to ask Pete Myers to take a first comment on that. Pete?
Well, there's a very large battle under. Hey, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah.
There's a is that over? Okay.
Yes.
So there's a very large public battle underway as we speak about the future of bisphenol A in the marketplace. Some of you will know that San Francisco just this year has banned the use of bisphenol A and also some phthalates in products intended for use of kids. That ban has been challenged in court, and right now it's been stayed, and there will be legal proceedings that unfold as the year goes on, which will be very important to follow. There are some other states that are looking into this. There is very little sign of attention to it at the national level. The FDA and the EPA basically have said that their current standards, which were based on 1984 data, are sufficient. But I should add, the EPA has asked the National Toxicology Program and the CEHR program to undertake a review of the bisphenol A, which will commence this spring.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Pete. I want to ask our partners to be very careful. We're getting background noise, and we want to. If you're not speaking and are kind enough to just use your personal mute, you know, we just got somebody's cell phone and so forth. So let's try to keep the line clean.
Michael, this is Allison, and I wanted to comment on Nancy's question, if
yeah,
I could.
Allison,
Nancy, I just wanted to point out that the Oregon Environment Council recently released some fact sheets on baby bottles that do not contain bisphenol A, and Sarah Dahl from CHE is distributing that, so I wanted to point you to that.
Thank you. Other comments, please.
This is Anna Soto, and I would like to add that there is a site called greenbaby.com that also offers not bisphenol A bottles.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Other questions, please.
This is Deborah Davis. Pete, do you know the status of the BPA bans in Europe now?
There is no ban in Europe.
It's been proposed. It's
been proposed, and it looks like it's going to be stopped. That is, the ban will not move forward. At least if politics play out as it looks like right now.
Other comments, please?
Yes, Pete, what about Japan, that normally they are more progressive?
Japan has not made a regulatory ban, but there's been some very interesting data coming out of Japan indicating that at least within some subsets of the population, bisphenol A levels are going down as a result of quiet moves by manufacturers to remove the epoxy rosins that are made out of bisphenol A from food cans. Most food cans in this country are lined with something like that. And Japan, if you go and sample food cans today in Japan, you find a much lower percentage of them use the bisphenol A-based rosin than was true 10 years ago.
Other questions, please?
That's a voluntary move on the part of manufacturers rather than a ban.
Thank you, Pete. Other questions from partners?
Toxic Reverend here. Can you hear me?
Yes. What's your name, please?
Toxic Reverend, I go by. What I posted on the blog was an email from Nicholson that dealt with mycoplasma infections and the relapse rates of breast cancer. And one of the things the professor had been studying was the interactions with infectious agents and toxic chemicals, and I haven't heard much about that. There seems to be an interplay where it taxes the immune system, if nothing else, to the point where the body has a hard time dealing with any toxic chemicals or anything else because it's also dealing with a subclinical infection. And
thank you
know
for that question. Dr. Soto, would you like to respond to that?
Well, I would like to respond by saying that although I cannot comment on that case in particular, it's known that you don't see any cancer, practically, any breast cancer, without alterations in the number of inflammatory cells. So many people that are part of this new epigenetic view of cancer sees inflammation and wound reaction as a stage of cancer. So therefore, there is an inflammatory component that has to do with tissue remodeling. I don't know about infection with mycoplasma in particular.
Thank you very much.
I did post.
Excuse me, Dr. Reverend. I like to keep moving to other people. So could we have questions from other partners, please?
Hi, this is Diane Sines with Science Communication Network. I'm new to this group, so still learning. Could Dr. Baer tell us how to find her recent research on fibroids?
Yes,
a link or a website?
I think there's now a link with Che.
Oh, it's on the Che website. Okay, great.
It's on the Che website, yes.
Great. Okay, thank you.
Michael, I'd like to ask some questions that are appearing on the blog, if you don't mind.
Yes, please.
There's a question from Margaret Braun from DES Berets. If you could design a study using a cohort of documented DES-exposed women and men, what would you like to see?
Are you referring to an epidemiologic study?
Margaret, are you on the line to clarify that question? Might be on the actual streaming audio, so I don't know. Just as a study using a cohort of documented DES-exposed women and men.
Well, as far as men goes, you'd want to have age-matched non-DES-exposed men, and you'd want to have a study where you would look for, with regard to the prostate gland, you would monitor their PSA levels and have rectal ultrasounds on a annual basis, and look for their rate of prostate cancer when they are diagnosed with prostate cancer, because it does occur at a very high incidence in the general population when they develop prostate cancer, to have that staged and determine the grade of the cancer. It would be important to determine if, and their age at which they developed the cancer, it would be important to determine whether the DES-exposed men were getting prostate cancer at an earlier age, whether they had prostate cancer at a greater frequency, or if when they presented with prostate cancer, was it more advanced or more aggressive type of prostate disease. And one could also do annual exams looking for testicular cancers as well, but my area of expertise is the prostate, and that's how I would be looking at men who were sons of DES-exposed women.
But Dr. Baer, there's another question for you on the blog. Some midwives have expressed interest in the interpartum period, but it's the first I've heard of the postpartum period being sensitive. Are there plans to look at this more closely? That's from Miriam Boline, Clean Water Action, Canadian Partnership for Children's Health and the Environment.
We're doing a small study interviewing people 3 months after their pregnancy to find out about their exposures during that time period, and then doing an ultrasound at that time to look at fibroids. So that's our study at this time. I don't know of any other studies, but I think it would be really interesting to learn more about that time period.
This is Ana Soto, and I would like to add that it's a very known, well-known fact that the risk of breast cancer increases right after pregnancy, although early pregnancy in the long term is protective. So that goes along with the comments that Dr. Baird expressed today.
Thank you.
This is Cheryl Walker. May I make a comment also?
Please.
I think that in terms of some of this epigenetic reprogramming that Dr. Prinz and I are most interested in, it's important to appreciate that different organs in the body develop during different windows of time. This is also true for different species. So, for instance, in the rat, whereas the uterine development takes place shortly after birth, of course, in women it's during the first trimester of pregnancy. But if you think of the breast as an example, the breast has a very large developmental window from before birth till first full-term pregnancy and maybe even beyond. So I think this concept that not all windows of susceptibility are going to be prenatal is a pretty good one.
I'd like to ask a question going back to Pete Myers' reference to the paper on Sir Richard Dahl and his estimate that only 5% of cancers are environmentally related to environmental contaminants, and ask each of the four speakers to just comment very briefly on, number one, in view of your research, does that 5% estimate hold up? And number two, given the current state of the science on cancer, endocrine disruption, and related and epigenetic reprogramming and so forth, is it even in principle possible to estimate what proportion of human cancers are related to environmental contaminants? Dr. Soto, would you address that briefly first?
Yes, well, I think that we cannot answer with precise numbers at this moment. What we can say is that, for example, the twin studies that have been done indicate that in most cancers, the genetic component is very small. And then in the case of breast cancer, the main risk factor is endogenous estrogens, as we know it. So you can, once you look at all these parameters, there is about 30% that you cannot attribute to anything. So probably that is a conservative estimate of what would be due to environmental reasons. Now, there is a study. There are studies now that are linking xenoestrogen exposure to breast cancer, and that is xenoestrogen exposure during adult life. So I think that evidence is accumulating that what you cannot attribute to endogenous factors that were prevalent before estrogen endocrine disruptors were introduced should be attributed to these new agents that are also estrogenic.
Thank you. Dr. Prinz, any comment?
The only comment, well, I certainly don't have any information about rates of prostate cancer as they relate to environmental exposures. I just would want to make one comment, and that is that when these analyses have been done by the American Cancer Society looking at different rates of prostate cancers around the country, they always notice a much higher rate of prostate cancer in areas where there's a lot of farming. And this has been documented not only in the United States, but also in some European countries. And there's the belief that this may be related to pesticide exposures from the pesticides that are used during farming, some of them, of course, containing xenoestrogenic activity. And so that's the only comment I could make about prostate cancer.
Dr. Walker?
Yes, well, I may be fortunate that I run in a more enlightened crowd, but that number of 5% never comes up. It's always much larger than that. Generally, when we think about the environmental component and the cancer-environment interaction, the numbers are usually somewhere between 50 and 80% of cancers have an environmental component. And there's, as Anna was referring to, twin studies, there's just a wealth of documentation for that. And it's obviously a continuum. So you have diseases such as retinoblastoma, which is a pediatric eye tumor, which is likely nearly 100% a genetic disease. And then you have on the other end of the spectrum mesothelioma, which is likely close to 100% of an environmentally related disease. So it's a continuum, but I think that most of the thinking, at least in my field, is that the environmental component is significant and equal, if not more, than the genetic component.
Thank you, Dr. Barrett. Any comment on that?
I agree completely, and I think the classic studies are the migrant studies, because people who come from an area of low risk and go to an area of high risk take on the high risk very quickly. It is not attributable to genetic changes and not to the environmental changes.
I think in fairness to Dr. Dahl and ACS and others, they don't dispute that the environment writ large plays a very major part in many cancers, because that includes diet, income distribution, and lots of other things. That 5% estimate was really about environmental contaminants. And so we would have to save for another call a dissecting of the contribution of environmental contaminants to risk. We have about 6 minutes left, I think, Eleni, if my clock is correct.
That's right, Michael.
Any last few questions or comments for the speakers?
This is Carol Becker from the American Cancer Society in Brooklyn. Based on the research that you're doing, are there any recommendations you could make to women now, practically what they could do to protect themselves? And B, if they knew they were exposed, are there any remedial steps they might take to decrease their risk of developing cancer?
This is Anna Soto. I think you can do many things to avoid exposure, like, for example, don't microwave plastics. Don't use plastic. Don't microwave in plastic, etc. So you can do a lot. However, at the end of the day, you won't know whether your exposure has been reduced by 5% or 95%, because these chemicals start accumulating. Say, for example, in milk, the minute milk gets removed from the cow and is piped into the place where it's pasteurized, it would be exposed most likely to chemicals that are estrogenic through the plastic piping. So I think that is both a personal issue and mostly a governmental issue that has to be addressed by regulatory agencies. I would like Pete to comment on this.
Pete, do you have a comment?
Actually, I think Anna summarized the personal decisions that one can make quite well. I would have added significant focus on the question of how much of your food supply comes via canned goods and attempting to reduce that. With respect to the public policy decisions, as I mentioned earlier, there is a very fierce battle underway as we speak. And I think it's fairly evident that if one looks carefully at the existing studies that have been published since 1997, and there are well over 100 of them that are examining the phenolase action at doses beneath the level that the EPA and the FDA currently consider safe. One looks at those studies. At the very least, it's clear there has to be a reassessment of those standards. Some scientists working in the field would go much farther than that and say that the standards are in the Jurassic.
Thank you, Pete. Last question or comment?
I do have one. I was wondering,
give your name, please?
Sorry, time for the Reverend again. There was a study about plastics where they washed it with a harsher detergent. It became extremely more toxic. It was on a Case Western University.
Mm-hmm.
I'll post it on the blog. And the other one was the interaction of things like mercury and pesticides. I have found very few studies where they look for combinations of toxic chemicals.
Thank you for that question. Dr. Soto, do you want to respond to that?
Well, yes. I think that there is some evidence that heavy metals could also act to get in conjunction with estrogens on the one hand. But studying mixture is a lot more difficult than studying a single compound at the time. However, this is what we are exposed to. So there are epidemiologists, there are people that are developing markers of total xenoestrogen exposure to address this issue, for example. Going with this multiple exposure that we have to several things, I would like to go back to the person from the American Cancer Society and say that exposure to sunscreens are also estrogenic, is something that women could curtail during pregnancy because they are estrogenic.
Thank you, Dr. Sarto. So we're going to wrap the call up now. I'd like to begin by thanking our five speakers, Dr. Pete Myers, Dr. Anna Soto, Dr. Gail Prince, Dr. Cheryl Walker, and Dr. Donna Baird for just one of the best CHE calls I've participated on. Just really wonderful, powerful set of research studies and observations. I also, again, want to call your attention to this forgive me for the superlatives today, but they're heartfelt, this extraordinary conference that CHE Fertility, Ali Carlson, and Linda Judice are putting on at the University of California, San Francisco School of Medicine from January 28th to January 30th. It's on the CHE website. We have a large number of CHE partners planning to attend, so it will be a place to meet colleagues and friends and hear from an extraordinary faculty. So I do recommend if you can include that in your travel plans. Many of us will be there. And with that, I'd like to turn it back over to Eleni Soto. So, Eleni?
Thanks, Michael. I'd like to also thank all of our speakers and our participants today for a really fabulous call. And I do want to mention, for those of you who came on a little late, our December national partnership call is titled Rethinking Autism for a Whole Body Paradigm. And if you are interested, please email Julia at healthandenvironment.org RSVP. Thanks so much, everyone. We look forward to your continued participation. Take care. Bye.
Thanks.
Good night.
Thanks.